This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beaten Track podcast. I'm your host, I'm Stu Whiffin. It's another week, therefore it's another episode. So today's episode, I sit and talk to John James Tufnell of St Agnes, and it's great. I'm not just saying it's great because it's my podcast, and I'm certainly not saying that my contribution to this conversation is great, but John's is. It's a bit of a heart warmer, this. There's just a lot of honesty and a lot of kind of just honesty about growing up and, you know, and not always fitting in. And we talk a lot about metalers and you know, how he's, you know, progressed from that scene and you know, still very much at the core of his beginnings and his love is that. And just to see the journey that he's gone on from there has been wonderful. And to talk about the records that have, you know, carried that journey as well, was just an absolute delight. You're in for a real treat on today's episode. Before we get on with it, just quickly, thank you to Scroobius Pip for being the podfather and being the boss man of the Distraction Pieces Network, which Off the Beaten Track is very proud to be part of. Thank you to 76 for producing this podcast. And thank you to you lot for continuing to push and grow this podcast. This started off, you know, 2 years ago as a little kind of side project to my other podcast, where I just wanted to try and grab an occasional chat with people that loved music and you know, had an interesting creative journey. And it's become so much more than I ever imagined, and I've been blessed to, you know, sit down with some absolutely wonderful people, and that's down to you lot continuing to support it and share it and tweet it and send me nice messages and you know, and recommend guests and stuff like that, and so thank you. Like, I really do appreciate it. And also, if, you know, in any way, shape or form you'd like to support the podcast in another way, then you can do that over on Patreon. There's no pressure or, you know, from me to go and do that. I understand that we're living in very trying times, but the option is there if you'd like to. You still get your, you know, 3 or 4 episodes each week on your Acast, Spotify and iTunes and all that for free. But if you'd like some more content, you'd like some video episodes and you'd like to get some radio shows and things like that, then I put up, you know, 3 or 4 bits of content each week over on the Patreon. And that will cost you about 71p a week. And then at the end of the month, that money goes into the pot to pay for the production and bits and pieces. So any help over there is really, really appreciated. But like I say, I totally understand that we're living in very testing times at the moment. So no pressure. And also you get a bucket load of stuff for free. And so, yeah, go and have a look in the back catalogue when you finish listening to this episode, because there's 250 chats to be enjoyed with. Yeah, I'm not even going to list them because there's too many now. But recent ones have involved the Foo Fighters, Chuck D, Motley Crue. So go and have a rummage and go and see what you like. Anyway, I think I'm done with all the kind of pre-chat waffle, and we can get to the premium waffle now. Please enjoy Off the Beaten Track podcast with the wonderful John James Tufnell. Right, I've got to take a quick break in this podcast because I've got some super exciting news. Off the Beaten Track podcast is proud to go into partnership with the Cacao Bar from Hotel Chocolat. That's right. The Cacao Bar is not a chocolate bar. It's all the best bits of a chocolate bar put into a really exciting new alcoholic range. That's right. Gin, vodka, and a beautiful range of cream liqueurs. So one of the big bonuses of this partnership is obviously I'm super thrilled to have Hotel Chocolat working with us, but they sent me a great big box of this stuff. And I'm telling you, it's amazing. Go and check it out, www.hotelchocolat.com or over on the socials at Hotel Chocolat. But yeah, in the coming months, there's going to be opportunities for you to get involved with competitions with us, to win bottles of stuff. There's loads of exciting things coming soon, and I can't be more happy to say that this podcast is in partnership with the Cacao Bar from Hotel Chocolat. All right, let's get back to the podcast.
It's Off the Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin.
Okay, we are recording. How are you doing, John?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good, good, good. Well, thanks ever so much for your time today. And before we start talking records, I just want to ask you how you found the last year as both John the Human Being and as a, you know, as a musician, as a creative.
Well, I mean, it's quite hard to separate those two things for us in the band, because the band has been our whole lives for the last 4 or 5 years. And as a musician, you know, I've been a musician for 20 years and everything I do is always focused at that. So I think that has meant I've always seen myself as kind of slightly outside the mainstream run of what's going on. So whilst I pay attention to the news, things that would affect other friends of mine, you know, worrying about house prices, worrying about this, worrying about that, I always just felt like something kind of from a distant land, you know. I didn't feel like I was kind of part of society. You always feel like you're kind of this sort of external thing. You're in a van together. You're this kind of, it's us against them kind of feel. But this situation has meant everyone's in the same boat all together. Everyone's experiencing it. And so it's kind of, in a way, there is one positive, and in fact, it's allowed me to kind of connect with some old friends and people and stuff and have a familiar, you know, focus on like, how are we doing? How are we coping? Which has been good. But the negative for us was that as a band, we were really, really reaching our stride when this all kicked off. And I know it's very easy to kind of be like, it's just music. It's just a band. It's not the end of the world. But as I said, it's our whole life. And everything that we'd work towards and we're really building. And, you know, this is every penny of our money and every moment of our day has been going into this. So there's nothing else. And so when things are going well and it's kind of like moving upwards, it feels really good. And we'd just been on tour with Monster Magnet after a whole year of quite extensive touring anyway, and the Monster Magnet tour was great. We were playing to bigger and bigger audiences, getting a really good reception. The Monster Magnet guys were super supportive, and then the very last show we did before lockdown was on Valentine's Day, supporting a band called Horror, which are heroes of mine and Kitty's, and so to meet them, to do a show with them, to have a great show, just felt great. And then we're like, right, we're ready for whatever's next. There's all this coronavirus news, but we don't really know how seriously to take it. And we had a whole year planned and it just stopped. And, you know, we were so ramped up energy wise and feeling like we're really in our stride as a live band. And to have that outlet taken away, we hadn't appreciated how important to our lives, our mental health and our general kind of well-being, that outlet of the live energy was, and the camaraderie of being in each other's company all the time, how important that was. We knew we valued them, but we didn't realize how fundamental they were. And then the other thing is just not having something in the calendar to look forward to.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, we love plans. We love our favorite thing about being in a band is going, right, we've got this big show coming up. What's the set going to be? What can we rehearse? What can we do to make it better? Everything is focusing towards that point. And at the moment, yeah, there's loads of things we want to do. There's loads of things are going to come up. But when they are, we don't know for sure what form they're going to take. We don't know. And that uncertainty, it's just really unfamiliar, disorientating place. And I think we share that with everyone, really, who's worrying about their jobs, family, when are their kids going to go back to school, all of those things, are we safe, everything. So it's a great leveler, but yeah. It's leveled us all down to a kind of like place of insecurity and fear.
Yeah, absolutely. That was really well put as well, John. Well, I guess one of the things that we always have as a guarantee and as a blanket and as a healthy distraction and a friend is records.
Absolutely.
And for track one, I'm going to ask you to tell me the song that you regard as having the greatest ever intro, please.
Okay, so I've chosen a classic, Enter Sandman by Metallica. I was a little bit uncertain about whether to go with this one, just because the song has become so overplayed. You know, it's like choosing Smells Like Teen Spirit or something like that. It's such a staple of the genre, but the reason why I've chosen it is there's a story linked to it, and that's that as a kid growing up near Southampton, the music scene didn't feel very apparent to me. I didn't really know what was there. I didn't really go to any gigs. I was just, you know, just a normal kid, like playing guitar, reading magazines, seeing things that were out there. And I used to go to a CD and record fair in Southampton Guildhall, which was loads of people like rummaging through boxes, looking for stuff, like spending 50 quid on double albums of rare things. But I was always looking for live bootlegs. That was like the thing I wanted of bands I liked. And they were really hard to find, you know.
On vinyl?
No, anything. Tape mostly, because I only had a Walkman really. So I was always looking for the cheapest thing. I had like, you know, I was 13, 14 years old. So I only had a few quid in my pocket. And quite a narrow taste in music. I liked things that were loud and still didn't really know what I liked. I was just, anything that was in Metal Hammer or Kerrang or whatever it was like, if I've read about it and the picture looks cool, I'll go and try and find it. And I can't afford the official things, but if I can find some kind of live bootleg or something on tape, then I'll get it. And there was this double album of Metallica live, just with handwritten stuff. It just looked like someone had made it at home. And as it turns out, it's a taped version of their Live Ship Binge and Purge massive deluxe box set they'd released in the beginning of the 90s. I didn't know that at all. And I put it on and says this live album, and it starts with Ecstasy of Gold from by Ennio Morricone from The Good, the Bad and the Ugly. And so it starts off this cowboy music. I'm like, whoa, it's incredible. Like the atmosphere just, as I was expecting, you know, just thrashing straight in, but it's this. And then the Enter Sandman riff comes in at the beginning, like the kind of creeping in, the sinisterness of it. And again, I hadn't heard the song. This was the first time I'd ever heard it. So it's totally overplayed now, but this was my first experience. And there it was, this like sinister creeping riff. And I was like, where's it going? And the drums come thundering in. Just going from the atmosphere of an Ennio Morricone piece and the glory and the religious experience it kind of creates. And then this sinister, we're here to mean business, going from this tiny riff and then just exploding. And you can hear, they have these cannons go off. You heard the crowd. And in my head, you know, I'm there. I'm just like, that's where I want to be. So that, yeah, just the excitement. I can hear it in my voice now. It's like, I actually, from preparing for this interview, I was like, oh, I'm going to check out to find this version of it. And it's on YouTube. There's a whole video. I didn't know there's a whole live show that is up there. And I was watching, and I was like, whoa, I'm just blown away again. So that's why I'm so buzzing now. I've just been watching it.
You don't really see the kind of bootleg things so much now. Well, I suppose because most people are just filming it on their phones and putting it on YouTube now. But
yeah,
like for you know, for people that may be listening that were too young to you know, really know what John and I are talking about, It was huge. And, you know, you could go to sort of Camden Market and there'd be stalls just selling just bootlegs. I mean, ridiculously illegal. But it didn't matter.
Yeah, it was, absolutely.
The amount of times that I bought on vinyl, like, live albums, and the quality was consistently shit. The recording quality was just shit. Yeah. And it still didn't stop me. I'd be like, next time, no. Do you know what? It probably ain't going to sound that good. And then the guy on the market would always go, oh, no, this is really good. Oh, all right, brilliant.
This one's, yeah.
Got it home. The audio was shocking, but it was just, it was a little bit more affordable.
Absolutely. And that was the attraction. I was getting hold of music that I was reading about in any way that I could. And our local HMV wasn't particularly well stocked with anything outside the mainstream. Mm. And so I was going to anywhere I could get it. You know, I had an older brother who was into rave at the time. So he was no good for finding music that I liked. His friends were pretty much into just rave as well. So like all my school friends were either just into mainstream music, or there was a couple of other people kind of like me, and we'd just try and share things between ourselves. And we didn't really understand the difference between bootleg or not. It kind of seems like people understand the music industry a bit more now, or maybe that's just my perception. I remember in magazines reading and people would talk about, oh, we've moved from this label to that label. It meant nothing to me. All I was like, there's a tape with Metallica on in a shop and I can afford it. I'll buy it. It was very simple. I don't think they probably financially missed my official purchases too much. I think they've done okay out of it.
Yeah. I mean, Metallica strike me as one of them bands that wouldn't be bothered about piracy or...
No.
I think they got on all right with Napster.
We can erase that part of the interview. Sorry, Lars.
It wasn't a bootleg. It was a legit copy of Black.
Yeah. I've spent a lot of money on Metallica since then. I don't feel too bad.
All right, John, for track two, I'm going to ask you for the first song you remember hearing that had an emotional impact on you, please.
Yeah, so I've gone with something. I thought quite long and hard about this because when you're young, the things have an emotional impact on you can be fairly straightforward. And so I was like, am I going to be honest here? And I decided, yeah, I'm just going to be honest. So I've gone for Blood on Blood by Bon Jovi. Which for anyone who knows our band and our kind of ethos might be a little bit surprised that I was an avid Bon Jovi listener as a teen. I don't know if you know the track, but it's an absolute blinding song in the way that Bruce Springsteen manages to write songs that just get to the heart of what he's trying to say. He just like unashamedly kind of creates a scene and a film in his songs and delivers the everyman working class hero thing. You know, he's in love. Bon Jovi did the same thing, but with loads of 80s glammy cheese thrown in. And as a teenager, I didn't notice any of that glammy cheese. I was just totally in love with the simple message of brotherhood in this song. Blood on Blood, Blood Brothers. You know, I'm 12, 13 years old, starting to become a teenager into that kind of like freaky time. You're nervous, like I was a skinny kid. The idea that you can be this kind of all for one, one for all, us against the world was really appealing. And hearing it in a song by these people singing it on a stage, and you'd see photos of them looking amazing, like everyone cheering. It's like, well, this looks incredible. As I've got older, I still love the song, but I love it in the way that I kind of like 80s films. I see them for what they are, and I love the nostalgia.
Yeah.
And I can totally put myself back into the mindset. And I get why the creative choices were made in the era they made, because they were often made uncynically, I think. It was the current thing. It was the music of the time. It was the film of the time. And now it's easy to look back and go, oh, it's really cheesy, it's really bad. But there's an honesty to what they were doing, in as much as they were trying to create the pure, perfect teenage anthem of brotherhood, and they made it.
But surely, you know, at that point, like, Bon Jovi would have had, you know, the best producers, the best technology. They would have had everything, you know, at their beck and call. And so when that album was being put together, you know, it was completely of its time, if not maybe ahead of its time. But the technology and that sound has just not dated as well as perhaps the aforementioned Springsteen.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. There's a more timeless classic thing to something like Bruce Springsteen that he's not so of an era that Bon Jovi were. And I think a lot of that's just tied in with the image, and anything where you present something that's very current, very of its moment, is always going to date quicker.
Fashion comes and goes, but style is consistent.
Exactly, exactly. And I can listen to that song and I can just laugh openly at it at the same time as kind of having nostalgic tears of joy.
Yeah.
And remember, I romantically remember the 13-year-old me uncynically listening to that song.
Yeah. But then, you know, you just nailed that, because some people might call that like guilty pleasures, but I just don't subscribe to that. I think if there's pleasure in it, it's a pleasure. And like, you know, enjoy it for what it meant, for, you know, for what it is now, for you know, I'm just never really kind of got that, oh yeah, you know, this is my guilty pleasure. It's like, why are you feeling guilty about something that feels nice?
I couldn't agree more. I just think the idea of attaching guilt to a pleasure as harmless as some music you like is just crazy. You know, of all the things to feel guilty about, listening to some music that some other people deem uncool is certainly not one of them.
100%, mate. The song that reminds you of your time at school, please.
So at school, I was a little bit of a outsider, I think, with my music taste. And I was always looking for stuff that seemed to be outside the mainstream. And one band that I absolutely fell in love with is a band called White Zombie. And so I've chosen their song Supercharger Heaven, which is off their big album Astro Creep 2000. And it's weird because if I talk to just about any musician in England, no one knows White Zombie, really. They know who Rob Zombie is, but they don't know White Zombie the band. But they sold millions of records in America. They were really big. They just didn't connect over here for some reason.
I think to a degree they did.
Did they?
You know, I mean, I don't know. I'm 47, and and of, you know, I've run an alternative venue for close to 30 years, and White Zombie were a big deal, like, you know, on the alternative kind of metal rock kind of scene, you know, when they were doing pre Rob Zombie becoming the Rob Zombie that most people know him for now. But that album's incredible.
Oh, it's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. I mean, I think maybe it could just be, it might just be my, you know, we're talking about childhood or school years, and I think the regionality of music scenes was quite a thing kind of in the late 90s. You know, the internet wasn't a feature. And so I think that I wasn't really aware. I didn't know anyone else that liked White Zombie. And that was enough for me to feel, where are all their, who are, there's people buying these records, but where the hell are they? I want to meet them. I want them to force them to be my friends. but yeah, That was Kerrang! Magazine. I opened it up and just saw this picture of Rob Zombie. I was like, fuck that guy, look at him. You know, I'm there dressing in clothes that like my mum had bought me, feeling kind of like a nerd and wanting to be cool. And there's this person who just looked like an alien to me. You know, Rob Zombie just looked like this intergalactic space cowboy from hell. And then on the next page is the bass player, Sean Yussel, who, for anyone who doesn't know, Sean is a female. And I saw this name, Sean, and this woman, I was like, am I looking at a man? Am I looking at a woman? Do I care? Does it matter? I'm intrigued. I'm excited. Like the whole thing. I was like, there's a woman in a heavy band, or there's a guy who totally is passing himself off as a woman in this band. It felt exciting and different and just setting itself up as like other. So I was already sold before I'd even heard a note. And their album was advertised as coming out, and I went and bought it on the day it came out, put my headphones in, and was just in their world for the next 2 or 3 years, basically. And I took the CD had an incredible inlay. Rob Zombie's a real artist, and he and Sean, I think, had created the band together. And both of them came from art and photography backgrounds. And as a result of that, their artwork was incredibly detailed, and it was in the era when record labels would have, you know, 40-page booklets for CDs and stuff. And that's why it was this huge fold-out thing. And every single song had a panel for itself with its own unique drawings. And then there was so much detail and tiny text all within it, and you could just spend ages looking at it. And that's what I did at school, just sat in the back row of classes, just like absorbed. So even when I couldn't hear the music, I was still in the world, and I was just in love with it. And that song, Supercharger Heaven, was the only one that if I went to like a friend's house and we'd have like teenage parties and stuff, everyone else was putting on Blur or Pulp, Oasis, stuff like that. And it just wasn't my thing at all. And I would sneak in and try and put something on, and everyone would be like, fuck's sake, John, just turn it off. But White Zombie, that song, Supercharged Heaven, for some reason just got the thumbs up from everyone. It was like, it was John's allowed song. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to put my song on now. And everyone liked it. Everyone was like, the chorus is like this, like, devil man chant. And I just loved it. And then me and my best friend at the time, we managed to convince our parents to allow us to go to Donington Monsters of Rock when we were 14. And White Zombie played at that. And we'd read that the Church of England had sent a priest to like sanctify the ground before they played, and we were just buzzing, like, you know, again, totally uncynical. Like now I'd see and be like, oh, this marketing ploy, I kind of see it more for this. I just was sold. I was like, this is great. And I was all about the music, you know.
How exciting.
Oh, it's just the best. It was just and when they came on stage, I was just, you know, we were in a whirlwind of like dreadlocks and hair at this front row. In fact, this guy, he flipped his hair back, and I'm sure that I swallowed a dreadlock. The chaos that happened when they came on stage, it was like suddenly I was like, here's all the people that love White Zombie, because I was in this massive mosh pit going crazy, kind of fighting for my life within it at the same time as like screaming with joy. It was incredible.
So do you think like it was around that time that you sort of found your tribe and found, you know, like-minded?
I discovered that they existed, but I struggled to connect with people where I lived who were like that. I was always, you know, I listened to podcasts like your own, I listened to people talking on the radio, you know, about their musical experiences, and I rarely hear a story that I feel is similar to mine. I'm sure they're there, I just haven't heard them. And it's just that I felt very isolated in terms of my tastes and what I wanted to do. I had some very good friends, but they weren't particularly musical, and they enjoyed elements of it and kind of going to the odd gig and stuff with me, but it was very much like a passing phase before they went to university, you know, that kind of thing, where I was like, I'm a lifer. Like this is, there's something more here. This is my religion. This is where I want to go, you know, with this. And I couldn't find people who felt the same, who shared, who were in it, who seemed to be in it for the same reasons. And that's not because they didn't exist. It was because I was probably too shy to talk to them. I was always quite uncertain about going and talking to new people. And so I didn't really find that full connection. And if I did go to a rock club or anything like that, the whole kind of like drinking side of metal, the whole kind of like Lemmy kind of from Motorhead kind of vibe of it, At the time, I just didn't get it. I was so all about the music. You know, when I went to Donington as a 14-year-old, and if I tell that story, loads of people are like, oh man, I bet it was crazy. You must have like got messed up. And so I was like, no, I got there and just watched every single band and had an ice cream halfway through. You know, I wasn't there trying to sneak beers in. I just, if I could get in, my body in and my ears in, that was all I was interested about. I wasn't bothered by the lifestyle. I found that quite off-putting and felt kind of alienated that some people were really attracted, particularly to heavier rock, by the lifestyle rather than the music. And it just seemed to be that every time I met people who are kind of like potentially kind of forming a bond with, they were more that vibe than people who were just about the music. And eventually when I did find some people, I just immediately formed a band, you know, and kept, I suppose each tribe I've been in has been much more just a very small gang. And it's always just been this kind of like little gang as a band. And I've enjoyed that kind of us against the world thing. I don't feel I've ever totally got connected to the wider community of it. But I think that's more my fault than the community's fault.
And I think, you know, if you're talking predominantly about the kind of sort of mid-90s to, you know, going back to what you were saying about trying to find people to go to gigs with that kind of wasn't just we'll go and watch this one band with John before we go. The mid-90s was probably a huge peak in this country for guitar music, but a million miles from metal. You know, it was, as the aforementioned Blur, Oasis, Pulp, it was high-flying, huge indie anthems everywhere at this point.
Absolutely.
So if you had a kind of desire to listen to guitar music, you was going to be pulled that way. And and one of the things I like talking about, when I talk about tribalism, when I asked you about, you know, did you feel like you found your tribe at Donington? And when you look at youth cultures and, you know, whether you call them grungers, whether you call them whatever, you know, there was indie kids when the Britpop scene was happening, you know, through to emo, whatever you want to call it. They've all come and gone, and we've, you know, and so many guests on this podcast will go, and, you know, I think due to streaming services and you know, just the way that the world has changed, that it does seem to be a far more universal kind of, you speak to younger people now and they're like, yeah, I love music. Oh, yeah, what music? Yeah, a bit of everything. Whereas, go back sort of maybe 20 years and it was more tribal. It's like, oh, I like drum and bass. You know?
And, okay, yeah.
And you'd wear them colours, you know? You'd be like, you could look at them and go, he's into drum and bass. And that's all kind of disappeared apart from metal.
Yeah.
Metal's the only tribe that still, like, you just go, he's a metaler. And like, and I don't mean that as a lazy kind of, you know, but it is, you know, I've seen so many different kind of tribes come through my clubs over the years, through from, you know, what was happening in Manchester in 89 through to Seattle, through to Camden, you know, through to new metal, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
You don't really get a lot of that fashion anymore, but the basic metal setup, it's always still there.
It is. And it's universal. You know, we go on tour because we're not a metal band. I don't, for anyone listening who doesn't know anything about my band, we're not a metal band. We take elements from metal. We love loads of metal. It just happens to be that's what I grew up on and have a real passion for in my earlier life. But when we're driving through Europe, every small town through to the big cities, there will be some metal people. Like there's always, when you're driving through, it's like there's a metal guy, there's some like kind of like cyber goth metal woman who's there. You know, it makes you realize how important it is for people who are into that subgenre or into that genre to display it. It's not just something that is part of your musical listening, it's part of your life. And I think that whilst I didn't personally become hugely connected to that wider tribe, it did let me know they existed. You know, when I was at Donington, I was like, every single person here is different to people I know, but there's thousands of them. You know, that was, I found it like an amazing experience to see that number of people who were living what seemed like a crazy lifestyle to me and just looked so different. You know, I was so conservative, like as a young teen, like in my dress, just being shy and everything, and just seeing this whole thing, like, wow, it's all there. And it's true though, that tribalism hasn't really left metal, and that kind of waving the freak flag high, I think, is the my favorite phrase to do.
I'm liking that. I like that.
Yeah. In fact, one more tiny bit, it's like a guy who used to roadie for my old band. He's one of my best friends, and he, if he's relating something, like he'll be like, I met this guy at a blah blah blah, and I was like, oh, what's he like? He's like, oh, he was cool. He was a metaler, and he always uses it as this shorthand for like he was a metaler, as though like, we know we can trust him. We know he's a good bloke. We know he doesn't take himself too seriously. We know that he's happy to rough it in the back of a van. You know, there's something kind of like this shorthand of he's a metler as this tick of authenticity that he's a good guy. And I was like, we can't, there's other facets to people's personalities than just the love of the riff.
Listen up.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
I've only got another new sponsor, Eggfried. It's this super cool clothing label. And if you're into sort of skating and street art and gigging and kind of like really cool art and throwing a little bit of Asian culture and the designer's kind of weird sense of humour in the mix, then you're pretty much there with the wonderful world that is eggfried.com. Now, they do these amazing punchy kind of graphic tees, hoodies and sweatshirts, beautiful art prints, as well as this, they have a denim range, all handmade in-house, all supporting the slow fashion movement. Not only that, they've given you a discount code, 10% off when you head over to eggfried.com. Just use the code EGGSALAD, EGGSALAD, save 10%. Go and get lost in the world of Eggfried. Also, they've got a new kids range, and it's called Small Fried, and it's super cool, super cute. And again, it's all over there in this wonderful world. Go and get involved at eggfried.com. Okay, for track 4, John, I'm going to ask you the first song you remember buying from a record store.
So I've gone for the Ghostbusters theme tune by Ray Parker Jr. This was, I can't remember exactly when it was. I was really young, and it was like proper pocket money stuff, you know, getting £1 a week from my parents and saving it up. And my dad was quite into music. His taste is not particularly great, in my opinion, but he was very into music. It formed, you know, as a relatively large part of his life. And so going to a record shop was something that he did quite often. So being a little kid and being like, well, next time we go, I want to buy something. Can I buy something? The thing I wanted to buy was it was a red 12 inch with a glow in the dark ghost on the front, the Ghostbusters logo. And I bought it just because of how it looked. I didn't know anything. And then we got home and turned the lights off and put it on, and there it was glowing in this song. And it turns out it's a really, really good song. You know, I got lucky with that first purchase and really enjoyed it.
What a cool first record. glow in the dark vinyl.
Yeah, I know. I don't have it anymore, unfortunately. It's somewhere, it's got lost in a move somewhere. I every time we move and I find some like old boxes, or I go to my mum's house or something and like, where's, you know, go through some storage, I'm like, maybe it's in here somewhere, but I still haven't come across it.
There'll be that moment like when they open the ark, you'll just open a box and it'll glow.
Exactly. It's Slimer, isn't it? It's like, yeah. Glowing out at me. Yeah, covered up in like ectoplasm, like joyous at finding this record. Yeah, but I absolutely loved it. And it's a really good song. And funny enough, I mentioned it to Kitty, and Kitty's the singer and like my main creative partner in St. Agnes. And she was in a band in her sort of mid-teens, and one of the songs they covered was the Ghostbusters theme. She was playing bass for it. And there's this really interesting little push on the bass that happens on an unusual beat that I've always loved. And she was like, yeah, like it, when we used to do that, we used to grin at each other, like we've got that part just right. And, you know, so it's interesting that song, as weird as it is, has formed a part of our musical story for both of us.
You mentioned your dad was into music. So yeah. What kind of stuff was you being sort of exposed to at home then?
So he was mostly into like 50s rock and roll originally. There was two definite eras of my dad's taste, which was 50s rock and roll, like Eddie Cochran's Summertime Blues, Buddy Holly stuff. And then moving into bands like The Who. And then a definite kind of gap between that and then real like 80s sort of Phil Collins, Dire Straits, Tina Turner. I never really was so into the 80s part of my dad's stuff. It was a bit too kind of soft for my taste. Mm. But I really liked the energy. When I was like 7, 8, 9, I really loved the energy of particularly Eddie Cochran's Summertime Blues. I loved the fact there was this like defining riff. And I think I remember saying, you know, what is that? And my dad's like, it's guitar. It's like, okay, well, I want to play guitar. And my parents did buy me a classical guitar. Just really kind of cheap thing, and got some lessons with a woman who lived down the road. And the very first thing we learned was Summertime Blues, which I was amazed that I thought this was going to be take me 10 years before I was going to be allowed to learn this iconic thing. And I was like, by the end of the first lesson, kind of fumbling my way through it. And I was like, well, I'm just hooked on this. This is incredible.
Wonderful. Well, fast forward in a few years, I'm going to ask you for track 5, the song that soundtracked your year's clubbing. So that obviously lends itself to rock clubs. That's not just...
Yeah, you know. Yeah. Yeah, I listened to your interview with Jack Besant from Reef.
Oh, lovely, Jack.
And he was saying, like, clubbing wasn't a big thing for him, but he was like, Motorhead, Ace of Spades, I think was the track that he chose first. And I kind of have a more, I guess, have a similar experience to him, that, like, my clubbing years weren't typically clubs, like heavy. My brother, as I said, was really into rave, and he was a DJ and totally into that scene. And in fact, you know, I tried with that style of music. I was like, you know, he seemed so into it, and it seemed something that I just wasn't into at all, but I was like, you know, I'll give it a go. And he took me to a rave when I was about 15 in a warehouse in Battersea. So this is the kind of rave that people who are into that scene talk about as like legendary. To prove that it really just wasn't for me, I actually fell asleep when I was there.
So could you not kind of draw the comparisons to metal insofar as both the energy and just the anarchic kind of concept of this abrasive DIY music, you know, being played in a warehouse, which, you know, it wasn't overproduced, you know, music being played in a chrome laden club. It was naughty, and it was different.
I think I totally understand what you're saying now I'm older. Yeah. At the time when I was 15, I was, you know, really into rock and metal, and it just felt like, I suppose, I just needed to see something that was truly live for me to be hooked on it. I wanted to see how it was made. I wanted to see someone playing guitar, someone playing drums. A DJ just wasn't enough for me. I get now what the appeal is, and I get the anarchy, and I get the I understand it a lot better. At the time, I kind of, you know, I'd just been listening to Bon Jovi like 2 years before as my main thing. Yeah. I wanted something maybe that was a little slicker. I wasn't really kind of at the anarchic point in my life at all. And actually, I haven't said what song I've chosen, which will help say it. So it's Nine Inch Nails' Wish is the song I've chosen for this clubbing thing. And this was a turning point in my musical taste where I really got into this kind of punky attitude that the music is something that you could physically throw yourself into. Like, so if you look at bands like Bon Jovi and Metallica and stuff, it's really well rehearsed and it's really quite pristine. And a lot of money's been spent on it. Nine Inch Nails felt underground and dirty and aggressive and full of punk anger. And I'm not a huge fan of punk, a lot of punk bands, but I love the punk attitude. And I found it in Nine Inch Nails' Wish. And so when I'd go to rock clubs at that time, a lot of the stuff that was being played that was things like the beginnings of nu metal, I suppose. And the only rock club in town was one called the Nexus in Southampton. And the DJ there, a guy called Keith, you know, he had total dominion over it. So it was just whatever he played was what we listened to. And he really liked dark wave kind of goth. And it just wasn't my thing at all. So you'd kind of wait through all this dark wave goth, kind of sat on the sidelines drinking Guinness in this smoke-filled room, waiting for a song you like to come on to go up and go crazy to. And suddenly, like, Nine Inch Nails would come on and it would often be Wish. And suddenly me and a couple of friends would descend on the dance floor and go crazy until the dark wave started again. And then we'd probably go outside for a cigarette or something. But that anarchic nihilism really appealed to me, particularly in my later teens, like early 20s, and really has become part of my outlook on live shows. You know, I think the way that Nine Inch Nails performed in their like classic era from the late 90s up to like 2010, those live shows, if you watch them on YouTube or anything, they're just raw and intense and so much about throwing yourself into the physical performance with no respect for the performance you've got coming tomorrow. Your plan is to like die on the stage that night. And I really associate, and really that appealed to me hugely as someone who would go into social situations and often feel like I hadn't made any kind of mark or anything. I'd left and been quite anonymous. The idea that you could just be like, not only am I here on the stage, I'm just going to give everything. That just appealed hugely. And so seeing a whole room full of people spring to life when that song came on in a club, in a rock club, and then seeing live videos of them playing it at Woodstock 94.
What a gig. You
know, with the mud and everything. I found it absolutely mind-blowing. And it really changed my view of what a rock show could be. It didn't have to be a well-produced Iron Maiden extravaganza. It could be something that was very well thought out and still have high production value, but the heart of it was about raw
primal as fuck. Like, yeah, really was.
Absolutely.
Have you watched the Song Exploder episode on Netflix?
I haven't done yet. I've heard about it.
Oh mate, it's just they're talking about how they, you know, wrote and put together Hurt, but
yeah.
Oh my god, like it goes into the excesses of touring at that point and that show and what basically Trent was doing to himself was just literally putting it all on the line every night, and obviously that takes its toll. And
absolutely,
but yeah, it's just, I think Trent Reznor, you know, and I rarely use this word, but I do think he is an absolute genius. I
couldn't agree more.
Yeah, I just think like hearing Pretty Hate Machine when that come out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was a big fan of electronic music at that point. You know, I loved Depeche Mode and lots of the industrial stuff that was going on. And then this kind of looked like he'd drawn all of the best bits of that and then just thought, right, I'm going to make this super angry and like, and just going to just throw some just disgusting guitars over it and just see where I can go. And it's just glorious. Yeah. Absolutely glorious.
It is glorious. Trent is incredible. And I talk about their classic era. It's classic for me, but I think that he's still making very relevant music now. It's not necessarily quite so to my taste, but I still think he's a very authentic artist who really kind of goes with his muse and what he wants to do. And I find that incredibly inspiring. He doesn't feel he has to repeat himself at all. But I think that there's two Trent Reznors. There's the very articulate, very intelligent guy in the studio crafting incredible sonic soundscapes. And then there's the same guy. He's on stage, covered in mud, wearing a pair of fishnets, smashing up a keyboard, trying to force some kind of... I think he's trying to force a moment of total freedom from his own need to control everything. And I really identify with that as someone who most bands I've been in, it's been kind of a solo project-ish. And I apologize to any former bandmates who are listening to this, but you know what a tyrant I was. I was really in control of everything and would micromanage every element. And so then when we're playing a show, I'd be really in my head and not really able to totally let go. And I'd come away feeling so disappointed in myself that my main reason for loving loud music and wanting to play heavy music was to totally lose myself and to stop being shy, to stop worrying about everything. And yet I was there worrying even more. And so seeing someone who just absolutely would blast through it, I think he's the same. I think he's trying to just forget what he's worrying about, forget the control, just absolutely cause true chaos so he doesn't know what's going to happen. And it creates these moments of like absolute beauty in it, of humanity for me. And Kitty and I, when we started St. Agnes, we were both still quite in control of what we were doing. And we would do, when we started playing shows, we realized quite quickly that we both wanted the same thing from the live show. And it was this more Nine Inch Nails, Trent Reznor experience to lose control. And we just fed off each other's energy with that. And our live show is now really wild. And they're not, it's not designed to be wild. They just are, because we, however careful we try and be in our preparation, we just lose our minds. And it's the most freeing, wonderful thing. And after a gig, you know, we can barely remember what's just happened. It's just so great. And I just love it. And that's what we've been missing so much during lockdown. You know, to go to that other mental state, it's not something you can really do when you're sat down watching Gardener's World, you know.
Well, let's take you home for track six. And I'm going to ask you for a favourite song from an artist from your home county, please.
Okay, so I'm from Hampshire, and I actually, I was always more into American music growing up, and so there wasn't a load of, like, bands I knew in the area growing up that I would like, you know, I'd love to have chosen some, like, really influential Southampton band that only I saw, but I've gone for Creeper and their song Cyanide, and that's quite a new track, and I think that Creeper are a really good band, and I think they're quite inspirational, in my view, for what can come out of Southampton. And that might sound silly because everyone's got to be from somewhere, but I always saw Southampton as kind of just, there was nothing I really liked about the music that was coming out of Southampton, and everything that did always felt like other people could be anything they wanted to be. But in Southampton, there seemed to be this attitude of kind of like chopping people down. Don't try and be too glamorous or too cool or too pretentious or too anything. It always just felt like it was like chopping people down to size. And I love the fact that Creeper,
I mean, he now all three of them things that you just put.
Yeah,
he's
exactly.
Completely glamorous. He's so cool. He's got all the kind of pretentiousness you want in a rock and roll star.
Exactly.
Like, Will nails that.
Exactly. And I think that's just brilliant. And like, I think he's probably 10 years younger than me, but I would have loved to have been in a band a few years younger than them, kind of back in the day, looking at them as like local heroes of, oh, if they're setting that outlier of what you could be, the, you know, they're writing songs that would do go great in a musical of like, you know, or they also write these great like screamo-y punk anthems that like just soundtrack teenage years. You know,
he's obsessed with he's been on this podcast, Will.
Yeah, I saw.
And he's also been on another podcast I do where I ask guests to pick a topic and then count down a top five. And he done top five moments from Jim Steinman. So the musical thing that you've heard in there is his absolute obsession with Jim Steinman, who obviously has made musicals and is obviously, you know, Bat of Hell and you know, and everything else. So that kind of flamboyance and musical kind of sound has definitely come from his love of that. Well, that's what I would imagine.
Yeah, and I find as someone who's grown up in the area, seeing a band come from the area who just don't seem to give a shit about all the stuff that used to worry me about, you know, worrying about being cut down to size. They're like, fuck it, we're doing this and we're going big on it. I just think it's great. And they make great videos. The production's really good. I haven't ever seen Creep Alive, but hopefully that will change at some point once lockdown's over.
Yeah. Have you met Will?
I haven't. Oh, I haven't met Will.
He's a lovely, lovely guy.
I know people that know him, and everyone always says great things about him. But yeah, I've never met him.
Yeah, he's a good guy. I hadn't heard too much about the band when I got to interview him, and then got the record, and then just, you know, got stuck into videos and stuff. And I think it's, you know, I totally agree that, you know, if you was a few years younger than that, messing around with guitar, you know, and not being particularly understood amongst your fellow pupils or whatever, and you saw that, you know, I just think that that would be definitely very, very sort of, you know, inspiring.
Absolutely. I think it's also really brave that they changed their sound so much from the first record to the second record, going from like quite like AFI sort of horror punk thing to this more kind of Bowie musical-esque thing.
Yeah.
And it works because it doesn't feel cynical. It feels like an authentic move. And that is the heart of good art, I think. If you do something, however pretentious it might be or however unusual a change it might be, if it's done for the right reasons, it rings true and feels great. It's only bad when people, quote unquote, sell out because they're doing it because they feel they should rather than it's their authentic musical selves.
Couldn't agree more. Right, it's the last track, and it's your time to turn someone onto something new, mate. And I'm going to ask you for a song that many may not know that you would like them to hear, please.
Well, the band I can't stop banging on about is a band called Horror, and it's spelled H-O-9-9-0-9, and their song United States of Horror. I could have chosen quite a few of their songs, to be honest, in this. I think they have a really good catalogue, and they're quite prolific. So Horror, for those who don't know, are a kind of hardcore punk industrial hip-hop act from New York, fronted by Gene and Edie. These just two crazy, I mean, just that they're so flamboyant and happy to kind of, again, wave the freak flag. They're kind of Rob Zombie-esque kind of guys. So charismatic and so compelling in their performance and their vocal delivery. And I've the exact same excitement I felt when I was a teenager listening to White Zombie, I felt for the first time again when I first came across Horror. I was with Kitty, and I had seen their name come up in something. I actually had a job in London that was involved with like music copyright and basically just looking at lists of stuff that was being pirated and all this kind of thing. And I just saw this name, and nearly all of that music was dance music. So anytime something came up that was not dance music, the name would stick out. And so there's this like Horror, and I was like, oh, I'm going to check that when I get home and listen to it with Kitty. And we're like, whoa, you know, this is something else. And I looked at photos, and their live shows are just chaos.
Have you seen them yet?
Yeah, we played with them.
Oh.
We, the, the very last show that we did, the one I sent out.
Oh, sorry, you touched on that at the beginning, of course.
Yeah, on Valentine's Day, that was with them. You know, we kind of like harassed them until they gave us a show. We're not the most natural musical bedfellows for them, like particularly from our first album, which was kind of more like a blues based. I say blues based, but there was a blues element within what we did, which I think a lot of people pigeonholed us as a kind of more like blues band. But we always saw ourselves as just twisting and utilizing a genre to kind of create something that to us felt kind of freakish and weird.
Sure.
So we, that kind of freakishness is like what we've always aimed for. And so with the following releases that we've done, what we've got coming up, we've kind of just used different elements, and seeing a band like Horror twist the genres that they're using and be so comfortable to just not care about how, what they might be perceived as or how they might be seen. It's just incredible. And as a live band, it's just absolute chaos. They're incredible. The drum, we've seen them twice. We played with them once and saw them another time, and with two different drummers each time. And the drummers they've had for the band has always been incredible as well. And like for the kind of music they're doing, having the live drums is really important. There's obviously a lot of electronica and things going on and loops and samples. And in my younger, more purist years, I was kind of a bit against that kind of thing. Like I said about going to a rave. As I got older and into Nine Inch Nails and everything, and understanding that, okay, there's ways of using this that's really sonic carnage that can be really exciting. Mm.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
I still think that having as much of it live as possible really helps in a live show, because that element of chaos and the drummers they've had have always been the totally like propelling them forward. And then there's just Gene and Edie at the front of the stage, you know, like Gene will be there wearing a wedding dress and like a balaclava and crazy long sort of like fingers or something, like glow in the dark fingers. And Edie will just like start taking his clothes off and head down. Jump into the audience, you're like, what is going on? It's incredible.
Wonderful. And I mean, you know, all of them things that, you know, I can see the kind of timeline from Nine Inch Nails to maybe Prodigy to Horror. I think, am I right that Horror actually worked with a Prodigy, didn't they? I think maybe on the last Prodigy record.
On the last Prodigy record, they did a song called Fight Fire with Fire with Prodigy. And Prodigy, like, a great, you know, we love, that's, you know, I could do a whole show talking about them as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that there is a definite lineage, Nine Inch Nails, Prodigy, Horror.
Yeah.
You know, those kind of bands that they're kind of punky, you know, like the Prodigy are kind of a punk band in a lot
straight
of ways.
Up punk band.
Like, you know, they started off with the kind of more rave thing, but it very quickly, you know, became darker and less about kind of Keith walking around with a beatific smile and a bit more about Keith, like, confronting the audience and the music feeling razor sharp. And I think that...
And it was...
That... Sorry, go on.
No, go on, sorry. What was you going to say? Sorry.
I think I lost... No. I think I've lost my train of thought there.
Sorry, I'll just get very excited when we start talking Prodigy. But I do think that, you know, you're talking about that kind of... That purist kind of attitude that you know, some metalers have of, you know, it's got to be this. Mm-hmm. It was bands like Nine Inch Nails and later bands like The Prodigy that, mm-hmm. you know, took... the rave to the rock and vice versa, took the rock to mm-hmm. the rave. And
yeah,
I just think that is something that band never get enough credit for. It's like, you know, how many bands could, you know, theoretically go on and headline, you know, Donington, headline Glastonbury, headline, you know, Creamfields, that band.
I know. It's genuinely incredible. And with so many hits spanning such a long, period of time,
yeah.
And if they play the old stuff now, it still works. Like, yeah. They've managed to reinterpret like the first album stuff when they play live. Like, you know, a lot of work's been done, obviously, on their show to bring those up to feel like, okay, they feel relevant to their more punky attitude now. And just a couple of years ago, just before Keith died, Kitty. Me and Andy, our drummer from the band, we went to see The Prodigy in London, and Kitty had never seen them before and was like, you know, didn't know loads about them beyond like the main hits. And we got there and I just lost her. As soon as it started, she was just gone in this mosh pit, and she came out at the end and she was like, that I've just had a religious experience, you know, that has just changed so much for me. She was like, I've been like, elbowed in the face, like walked all over and had the best time of my life. And she just was absolutely buzzing from it. And I found that really inspiring because I was getting to see the excitement that I'd felt about similar bands, which I didn't really get to share with anyone back when I was a teenager. I was getting to vicariously enjoy it through Kitty's newfound love of these things that she had kind of like come across. It's like to be there when someone like opens that Christmas present is quite exciting. And then we fed off that energy a lot. And the second record that we did, The Family Strange, we definitely had a Prodigy influence in there in some of the beats that we were using. You know, our drummer Andy, we really pushed him to be like, you know, if the Prodigy are making beats that are that danceable just from samples of real drums, but makes something, you know, we can make something as danceable and as heavy as that with a real drummer. Like, let's go for it. That should be our benchmark. Let's, rather than referencing Led Zeppelin with a live drum kit, which has been done 1,000 times, let's see what we can do. Can we do a beat that Liam comes up with from The Prodigy on a real drum kit? And then if we're thinking like that, what's going to happen with the guitar riffs? You know, I'm fundamentally a kind of punky bluesy player. What am I going to do over that drum beat? Let's see what happens. And that was really inspiring for us.
Wicked. Well, let's hope that we, you know, that the cinemas will be open in time for us to all go and enjoy the documentary that's being made.
The documentary.
Which going to be something special. You know, I'm looking forward
to it. I think it's going to be quite emotional for a lot of people because they're such a fundamental part of some people's formative memories around music. And then the sad story for Keith, you know, it's I think there's going to be a lot of emotion and a kind of sadly tinged joy that comes from watching like incredible performances that have the tragedy alongside it.
I was lucky to see them up, but you know, they're from Essex where I'm from, and to see them at V97 or 87, I believe, when mm-hmm. Fat of the Land was the biggest record, you know, in the world. And to see them come home and play their own back garden. And to this day, I've not seen a gig anywhere near as good as that. Poison played live at that V Festival was the greatest moment of any live experience I've ever had. And it was just huge and glorious.
Oh, I can imagine. I can imagine. And those moments, they transcend a audience member watching a band perform and hearing some music. It's just your whole being comes into line with all these other people and with the music, and you just feel like you could do anything in that moment. You know, you feel like the power of yourself and the collective and everything is so like transcendent. It seems absolutely incredible. No, I can hear in your voice the same thing that I was talking about earlier on the first question about Metallica, that thing of like, oh, I feel such emotion about it. It's deeply moving.
Well, John, we put together a playlist for Spotify with all of your song choices on and some of the other records that we've chatted about throughout today's conversation. I can't thank you enough for your time today. You know, we should have recorded this yesterday, but my internet literally collapsed. And so you were very gracious and rescheduled for us to record today. And I'm so glad you did, because I've had an absolutely wonderful chat, man.
Yeah, well, thanks so much for having me on. It's just a real pleasure to get to actually talk about some of these things. You know, when you do most interviews, you're just trying to plug your most recent record, and you very rarely get to delve into these things and relive some musical moments that I haven't thought about for a long time. You know, as Kitty said to it, she goes, the anti-toxic masculinity of listening Blood on Blood by Bon Jovi. You know, it was the only way that me and my 13-year-old friends could show each other we loved each other was to kind of punch the air along to this anthem, because we were too scared to tell each other we loved each other. So that was the vehicle that was there, and so wonderful. Having the opportunity to talk about that kind of thing is very rare, so thank you very much for having me on.
Oh, it's been an absolute pleasure. So in regards to the band, what's happening?
So we have released a couple of singles from our upcoming mini album. The mini album is going to be called called Vampire, and that is out in March on the 26th. We've got the main single, Vampire, the single, coming out on the 26th of February. So as a band who we are totally DIY, we make our own videos, we mix our own music, everything. There's a lot of work going on. So we've just finished making the third video for the mini album, which under coronavirus lockdown rules is not an easy task, I tell you that much. We just got loads of new music coming out, basically. And we've got some bits and pieces, some live things that are going to be coming up online, which I can't say too much about right now, but people will be able to hear some of the new tracks played live, which will be exciting because we've never really played them together. We wrote them and recorded them, stood as far apart from each other as we could, having very minimal rehearsals, and we haven't had a chance to actually like properly knuckle down and make some noise together in quite a long time. So we're setting up a date for when we can do that.
And if people want to find out, you know, all about that and everything else that's going on with your releases and stuff like that, where's the best place to keep up to speed with a band?
I mean, Facebook and Instagram is the main port of call. Everything that we do goes up on there. We also have a fan club called the Death or Glory Gang, which is, I guess, it's a bit more than a fan club. It's our hardcore early supporters of the band. Anyone who kind of went above and beyond in terms of helping us find a place to stay on tour or buying some early deluxe product that we made to try and fund what we're doing, we added to a list, and we send them gifts from time to time, and have this kind of like hardcore group of people. So I'd like to just give a quick shout out to the Death or Glory Gang that are listening and say that we don't show you guys enough love, but we absolutely do love you, and we can't wait to hear what you think about our new record that's coming out.
Wonderful. I just want to thank you again. I've had a really, really lovely time. Thanks so much, John.
Thank you very much, Stu. It's been a pleasure.
How nice was John? I just told you that was going to be a really nice kind of heartwarming one. And I just love it when people are so open and honest about their passion of music and, you know, that kind of journey. And it's everything this podcast is about. And, yeah, I can't – I can't thank John enough for it. And yeah, yous are still here. So yous have enjoyed it as much as me. Thanks ever so much for listening to this podcast. Thanks once more to John. As mentioned in my kind of pre-show waffle, go and have a look in the back catalogue. Go and get stuck in if this is your first time listening. Subscribe, that really helps. If you're on iTunes, drop us a review, you know, or rate us. All of these things help to kind of get the word out there. And, you know, I say this week in, week out, but if you do see us on the socials, give us a like, a share, a retweet, you know, or whatever else you can do, a comment. And if there's guests that you'd like to hear me chat to, drop us a line, let us know. And if you want to support the podcast, you can do that on the Patreon. You can find out about everything you need to know at www.offthebeatandtrackpodcast.com. Thanks loads, lovely people. I'll see you next time. Be excellent to one another. See you soon. Bye-bye. I've got an announcement. Save Our Souls Clothing. www.sosclothing.co.uk. Why am I telling you this? Because they're our official sponsor. Yeah, that's right. Go and check them out because their clothing is off the scale. You're going to love it. So they've decided they want to be our sponsor, which is amazing. And what I have to do is I have to tell you about why they're amazing. So here's a little bit of blurb. So they've only been going a year. And they're based in Southend-on-Sea, just up the road from me. They put the company together based on a love of tattoos and alternative music. And they've worked with some of the greatest artists around the world to produce these items of clothing that are as unique as you lot. All the designs are printed using biodegradable, sustainable and water-based inks. In addition to that, they only print on garments made by members of Fair Wear Foundation. I mean, come on, great clothing and a conscience. Since going live in April last year, they've seen their audience grow massively and are now selling orders all across the world. And they were recognised by Cosmopolitan magazine as one of the best sustainable clothing brands alongside names such as Stella McCartney. I mean, that's quite a first year, right? So go and check them out because they've put a lot of love into supporting this podcast and I couldn't be happier. What else they've done is they've given you 15% off. So if you head over to www.sosclothing.co.uk, do a bit of shopping, see what you like, throw it in the basket, and then on the way out, put in the discount code BEAT15, BEAT15, and that'll save you 15% off. Amazing, right? www.sosclothing.co.uk, official sponsors of Off The Beaten Track podcast.
It's Off The Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whippin.